Shabbat shalom, everybody.
Shabbat shalom.
All right. Well, today we're going to pick up again with our Sermon on the Mount series, following up from last week. So it was like part one. This is sort of part two of that message that we're on. And we're actually in the 18th message of the whole series. So we're working our way through. Maybe we'll finish by the end of the year. I'm not sure. We'll try. But picture this scene. Just go back again. Yeshua standing on the grassy hillside, overlooking the Sea of Galilee. There are crowds stretching down the gentle slope, likely in the thousands. There were Purushim, the Pharisees. There are scribes. There are Torah teachers. There are leaders from synagogues in Capernaum and Magdala, with some having come down from Jerusalem and Judea. Kohanim were likely there too, connected to the temple in Jerusalem. There were Greek-speaking Jews from the Decapolis, shaped by Hellenistic culture, some benefiting from the Roman system. They were standing near zealots committed to armed resistance, and woven through the crowd were Jewish pietists, philosophical seekers, even Essene representatives who were known for their withdrawal from society and their sharp criticism of corruption in the temple. But most of the crowd was made up of ordinary Jews, fishermen from Capernaum and Bethsaida, farmers from the Galilean hills, women, children, families from towns like Nazareth and Magdala. These were the Amharets, the observant people of the land, living under Roman occupation and longing for hope, longing for a redeemer, longing for new life. And so today we're in Matthew 6, and Yeshua speaks to everyone in this diverse audience. Beware of practicing your righteous actions in order to be seen by others. Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. And then he names three examples: tzedakah, which is giving, prayer, and fasting. These are practices central to Jewish life. He begins with tzedakah, warning that even holy acts can be corrupted by the wrong kavanah, the wrong heart intention. And we've covered tzedakah in some depth some weeks ago. And then last week, we turned to prayer. So that's where we are now. Last week, we laid foundations for Yeshua's teaching by grounding prayer in the world of Jewish prayer itself. That was the idea. And so building on that today, I want to take a closer look, an exegetical look, at what Yeshua is actually saying about Jewish prayer. So we're in Matthew 6, verse 5 through 6. When you pray... And that was the big thing we talked about. When you pray is part of the whole Jewish world of what Jewish prayer is. When you pray, do not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the street corners, so that they may be seen by others. Amen, I tell you, they have their reward in full. But when you pray, go into your inner room, and when you have shut the door, pray to your Father who is in secret. And your Father who sees in secret shall reward you. And when you pray, pray like this. And then we have the Avinu, the disciples' prayer, which we'll save for another day. Now, to understand why Yeshua says this, we have to hear it within the world of Jewish prayer. So last week we saw that prayer is part of Israel's calling, avodah. Prayer is given to us by God as a source of life, intimacy, renewal. As Messianic Jews, prayer is our sacred responsibility. We saw that Jewish prayer grew directly out of the temple system for sacrifice. Psalms and prayers surrounded the offerings, keeping Israel connected to the worship that was happening on the altar. So this is critical to understanding Yeshua's words. Why would Jews be praying publicly at all? Standing on the street corners or standing in the synagogues. During the Babylonian exile, Daniel prayed three times a day facing Jerusalem at the times of the temple sacrifices. And like we talked about last week, from the rhythm, this rhythm emerged Shacharit, Mincha, and Mariv, the morning, afternoon, and evening prayer. Shacharit corresponds to the morning Tamid, the daily animal sacrifice. And Mincha corresponds to the afternoon Tamid, the second daily sacrifice. And Ma'ariv aligns with the evening temple service when the portions, the remaining portions of the animals that were sacrificed that day that couldn't be eaten by the Kohanim were burned. The word Tamid means continual. the regular daily offerings that sustained Israel's worship before God. And so by the first century, daily prayer was already tied to these sacrifices. And while the prayers themselves were still taking shape, some similar to what we have today, some different, communities we know prayed the Shema. They prayed different early oral versions of the Amidah, like what we prayed today, just, you know, different order, and it wasn't quite codified the way it is today. That's the standing prayer, which mirrors the sacrifice itself. So these rhythms were so deeply ingrained that after the temple's destruction in 70, Jewish prayer preserved continuity with the temple. And so this is how Judaism survived in the diaspora. So when Yeshua speaks about prayer in the synagogues and on the street corners, he's speaking about avodah, worship that stands today stands in the place of, and then it was alongside of, the sacrificial system. So, okay, what does Yeshua mean by the hypocrites who love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the street corners so that they may be seen by others? So let's talk about stand in the synagogue. He may be addressing those who lead public prayer. In the first century, synagogues had designated individuals who would stand at the front like we do and are invited to lead prayers. Like today, leading prayers was a real honor within the community. Honor is good. It's a good honor. There is honor in serving as a cantor or reading from the Torah. These are things they did. Public prayer is holy, it's sacred, and we should strive for excellence and holiness and honor in these public readings. But this honor comes from serving God. If you stand up and lead prayer in order to be seen or to gain approval or praise or social power in your community, then you're simply serving yourself. You're not serving God. What about street corners? Jewish prayer is fixed with time. So daylight is divided into 12 seasonal hours, and Shacharit is prayed from sunrise until the third hour. Mincha begins shortly after midday and continues until sunset, and then Ma'ariv begins at sunset and can be prayed all the way until the following sunrise when you would shift over to Shacharit. So because prayer was tied to fixed times and because people walked everywhere, it was common to pray wherever you happened to be when the time arrived, in the marketplaces or along the road or, you know, at different public places. So you still see this today in ultra-Orthodox communities when a minyan forms outside for mincha in the middle of daily life. You'll see that. And this is a beautiful tradition of prayer. Yeshua is not criticizing fixed prayer or praying in public. He assumes that this is normal and this is good. That's part of when you pray. Just like giving tzedakah, prayer is a righteous action that's meant to serve God. And like tzedakah, it also carries a danger. A good act can be subtly twisted when the reward that we seek shifts from serving God to be seen by others. And that's why Yeshua uses hyperbole. He uses provocative extremes to expose more subtle things that are happening in the heart. So it's entirely possible for someone to be very intentional about when and where they prayed, to arrange things so that the time of prayer arrived when they happened to be standing at the most visible public place that was strategic for their social arena. And Yeshua's warning is simple. When it's time for mincha, don't position yourself to be noticed on the busiest street corner or in the most important spot just so that others will see you. So why would someone want to be seen davening in the first place? You know, thinking about this, on the more positive side, some likely prayed publicly to model for others. Say, if people see me praying, then they'll pray too, and maybe that's a good thing. Some probably just wanted to belong, to be recognized as insiders in the religious world. Others sought honor and influence and social power. At this time, the prayers weren't written down in Siddurim like we have today. So you knew them if you were learned. And many Jews in the Galilee, for example, didn't even know Hebrew. In synagogues, they would raise a white flag to signal when the congregation would say amen after the Torah blessings, because we didn't know. So they'd raise a flag, and we'd say amen. Public davening could easily become a way to display education, to display piety and status. Remember who Yeshua is primarily addressing: the poor, the meek, the mourners, the persecuted, whom the religious elite dismissed. Some sneered in Yochanan's Masorah, the crowd that does not know the Torah, speaking to Galilean Jews. And we see this in the rabbinic literature too. I imagine A knowing laugh rippled through the crowd when Yeshua said, "Don't pray in the synagogues or on the street corners, you know, where people can see you." They knew exactly what he meant, and they knew exactly what he was talking about. "Don't be like the hypocrites," he says. Now here, a hypocrite is not like, we think of a hypocrite as just someone who's inconsistent, doesn't do what they say they're going to do, or does, you know. But I think the definition that's being used here is an actor, a pretender, someone who performs the right actions, but for the wrong reasons. So the person prays on the street corner, which is good, but he doesn't pray to glorify God, he prays to glorify himself, and that's not good. He's not really praying at all. He's performing. In my early 20s, before I knew Yeshua and before I was really trying my best to walk with God, I was a yoga teacher. And I was drawn to the flashiest kind of yoga. And at that time, I was like 21. I was super strong. I could do impressive poses and balance on my hands and do pretzel shapes and upside down stuff and all these things. But I remember... It's kind of embarrassing. I remember I would choose the best spot on the lawn at the yoga center, positioning myself so that when the right people walked by, you know, I would do the most impressive pose, and then they would notice, you know. I first read Yeshua's words on prayer in the Sermon on the Mount when I was still in this world. I was just beginning the Appalachian Trail and still in this world, and I remember these words cutting me. And after... You know, a few weeks later, I surrendered my life to Yeshua, and he changed me. He changed me forever. And just to be clear, yoga is not spiritually neutral. Its postures and framework comes from Hindu worship, and it's not something I practice or teach today. So turning away from that world was actually part of my turning to Yeshua. I had to leave that world behind. So Yeshua says... Don't be a pretender. That's the point here. Don't be a pretender. When you pray Minka or any of your prayers, don't position yourself in the best place to be seen by other people. Instead, go into your inner room. And more than that, close the door. What's going on here? Some Christian communities have read these words in the past and minimized public prayer. But I think that misses the point. Yeshua is not forbidding public prayer. He's doing the same thing he does with giving. He says, don't sound a trumpet, give in secret. Public prayer is not the problem, it's the heart behind it. And Yeshua knows that our motivations are so mixed and so complicated that he uses strong, exaggerated language to get our attention. And that's what he's doing. He's using hyperbole. The word inner room is temeon. It's a windowless storeroom, often only locked room in the house. It's the only place you can get with a locked room. It's like in the center, where you store your vegetables. It's the most private place possible. So this is hyperbole. If you're going to be strategic about where you pray, then at least be strategic in the opposite direction. Completely remove the audience entirely. This word echoes Isaiah 26:20, where Israel is told to hide their inner rooms, the same word is used in the Septuagint, and to wait for God's deliverance. So I wonder if Yeshua was connecting to Isaiah 26 when he speaks of this inner room, and perhaps he's pointing us toward the prophets. Don't seek your own glory. No, remember the prophets and seek God and his promises in that quiet, hidden place of trust in your heart. Prayer isn't about being seen by others. It's about giving your full attention to your heavenly Abba, your heavenly Father, heart, soul, and strength. So when Yeshua says of tzedakah, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, he's naming this tension inside of us. The right hand represents genuine service to God. The left represents this pull towards recognition and approval. So he says, remove the temptation. Give and pray in a way that's secret in your heart. Protect your worship. I think that the inner room is not a universal role. A universal rule. I wouldn't take it that way. Think of Daniel. He prayed openly at his window in order to be seen when prayer was outlawed and paid for it with the lion's den, which he was rescued from, of course. But he was seen by men, but not for honor and not for status. His prayer was faithfulness, not performance. It's important that as Messianic Jews, we see that Yeshua is also not critiquing Jewish prayer. I think it's quite the opposite. Yeshua is drawing his disciples deeper into Jewish prayer. And as we said last week, we're called to be salt within Israel, carrying covenantal worship with integrity within our people. Yeshua's concern is simple and demanding. Our worship is to be pure. There are many ways that I think this applies to all kinds of prayer today. You can think of all kinds of things, from liturgical davening and, you know, and looking over your shoulder to see who's watching and, you know, that kind of thing, to spontaneous prayer at a gathering and how well you craft your prayer with other people, to raising your hands in worship, you know, so that you'll be part of the gang and fit in, falling on your knees, you know, in order to look a certain way or gain some sort of social approval or status within a community. Even prayer languages can be like this. I think everything can be like this. All these things are good things. You know, these are all good things to do if they're coming from the heart and they're meaningful. The question is always the same. Are we seeking to be seen by others, or are we seeking our Father who sees in secret? And this temptation doesn't disappear in the private prayer room either. You can go into your inner room and lock the door and have a wonderful time of prayer, and you can still turn the inner room into a stage just by sharing strategically with the people you want to impress. So be content with the reward your Father gives: his approval, his love, his presence, his life, being part of his story, being part of his people, being part of his redemptive plan in the world. Now, Yeshua turns to a different danger in the next verse. In verse 7, he says, "When you are praying, do not babble on and on like the pagans, for they think they will be heard because of their many words. Do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask him." Beautiful. Now, it's interesting because Yeshua shifts for the first time in the Sermon on the Mount. He moves from comparing to inner Jewish discussion to comparing with the nations. Do not pray like the hypocrites, which is an in-house conversation, to do not pray like the pagans. Now, the Greek word translated Babylon can mean empty or idle or meaningless speech or words without substance or intention. In the Greco-Roman world, pagan prayer often involved formal invocations with long lists of names and things, repeated phrases, and even magic formulas. What matters was saying the right magic formula, the right words, sometimes in precise sequence or in repetition, to appease a god or to compel divine action. These words themselves were believed to carry power. And by contrast, Jewish prayer was never meant to manipulate God. It's meant to meet him. It's meant to encounter and to cultivate a relationship that's rooted in covenant and trust, praying to a Father who already hears and already cares. Now, a few qualifiers on this so we don't misread Yeshua's words. First, this is not a warning against repetition or passionate persistence in prayer. Yeshua himself repeats his prayer in Gethsemane 3 times. "My Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me, yet not my will, but yours." He repeats that 3 times. Second, this is not about prayer being long or prayer being short. Yeshua prayed for extended periods, sometimes all night. He taught his disciples to pray persistently and keep knocking on the door and never lose heart. In first century Judaism, prayer length was actually a lively discussion, and it was debated. And there's different, you know, rabbis who thought long prayer was better and some who thought short prayer was better, and be another message to kind of unpack all of that. But the way that it's resolved is that it depends on context. There's not a fixed ideal. What matters was discernment in the direction of the heart behind your prayer, whether it's long or short. And that's the key here. Length is not the issue. Intention is the issue. Prayer flows from dependence on a Father who already knows our needs. And third, it's not a rejection of set or liturgical prayer. In fact, Yeshua is just about to give his disciples a prayer to pray. So that brings us to the heart of what Yeshua is saying about prayer. Jewish prayer is not about gaining honor. It's not about social standing. It's not about control. It's also not about manipulating God and forcing his hand. Instead, Yeshua is looking for trust. He's looking for devotion, a heart that genuinely seeks him, like King David, a man after God's own heart. Prayer is our avoda. It's our worship. It's our sacrifice. It connects us to God's story. It builds us, binds us to his people in covenant. It draws our hearts into alignment with his will and with his work in the world. At its core, prayer is about relationship. Now, prayer is not us reaching up into heaven to change God's will to match ours. It's the opposite. We reach into heaven so that our will can be aligned with his. And prayer is like pulling heaven down to earth and becoming part of what God is already doing in the world. You see? And that's why there's nothing too trivial that you can bring before God. You can't say, oh, well, God doesn't care about that, or I'm bothering him, I'm wasting his time, you know, with these things. It isn't like that. We're not boring to God. We can plead with God. We can cry. We can weep. We can laugh. We can bring him our fears and our desires, not to manipulate him, but to invite him in, to be transformed in the process, and to be transformed by his purpose and his values and his work in our lives. And that's why there's simply no place for prayer as performance or prayer as manipulation. There's a Hasidic folk story about the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement in the 18th century. A learned man once came to visit the Baal Shem Tov and said, I've studied and memorized all the prayers. Now, I want to truly master prayer. The Baal Shem Tov surprised him, and he said, go to a certain village, find a farm boy who works in the fields, and he'll teach you how to pray. Confused, the man went, and he found the boy, and he exclaimed, the Baal Shem Tov sent me to learn how to pray. So tell me, what do you do? The boy answered simply, I don't know the prayers. I'm unlearned. The only Hebrew I know is the alphabet. So what do you pray? The man asked. The boy said, I go out into the fields and I say Aleph, Bet, Gimel. And then I say, God, I don't know the words of the prayers. I only know the letters. Just arrange them and make the right prayer. I don't know what to say. So why are the first three letters of the alphabet all that we need? Because your father knows what you need before you ask him. For the Baal Shem Tov, learning Hebrew and learning our prayers mattered deeply. He himself was highly learned. The Siddur is the heart of our people, and we should always desire to grow in it. But no matter how much we know or how little, we must never forget that the prayer of the boy in the field, a heart that's turned toward God in trust. The Apostle Paul writes, in the same way, the Ruach also helps our weaknesses, for we do not know how to pray as we should. But the Ruach himself intercedes with us with groans too deep for words. And I think this gets at the heart of prayer beyond words. Even prayer in a prayer language or tongues or something like that, or a nagun that we might sing. There are moments when language fails us, when we no longer know what to say or how to say it, and we stop striving for right words and we entrust ourselves to God. And I want to close by coming back to a story that I shared a few messages ago from Richard Wurmbrand. I don't know if you remember, who was imprisoned by the Soviet Union for 8 years in solitary confinement because of his faith. And a few months ago, I shared the whole story. But I just want to quote one quote from him about his time in solitary confinement. I would walk back and forth every night. I would meditate on the verses in the Bible that I remembered. And then hours would pass praying for the whole world. Every night I would deliver a sermon. There was no visible audience, but I preached to God. I preached to angels. They are also interested to know what I think and what I have to say. And then I would pray. But then they started to add narcotics to my food, and I could no longer remember what to pray. It was one of the most desperate moments in my life. When I tried one evening to say the Lord's Prayer, I found out that I forgot it. I said, O Father, holy is your name, and then I forgot the rest. So I said, Yeshua, I love you. Yeshua, I love you. I think that's prayer enough. Then I could not even do that. Then my only prayer would be the beating of a loving heart. Your Father knows what you need before you ask him. We'll stop here. And next time we'll see how Yeshua teaches us to pray from the secret place, a place of trust. Shabbat Shalom.
set the people in the mouths of the house of Israel. And may your descendants and the descendants of your people Israel be those who know your name and study your Torah. For Messiah